This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Welcome to the ACAMS In Conversation series. I'm Prabha Chobina, Publications Manager, Deputy CEO at ACAM. Today we're talking to Dr. John Ivins, Head Teacher of the Bethlehem and Maudsley Hospital School in South London. John is also an educational psychologist and has served as advisor for children's charity Place to Be. We're here today to talk about mental health in schools.
Okay.
Hello and welcome, John.
Hi.
Thank you for taking time to speak to us. Can I begin by asking you to tell us a bit about your school and what resources you have to manage the spectrum of students you are catering for?
Well, we're a 4 to 19-year-old school, so we've got full range, really. And we're across four different departments. We've got two acute adolescent wards and a children's ward, which goes up to 12, and a service which works with adolescents with eating disorders. It's a day service which they're in for about 7 weeks in total. So the resources we have are spread across two sites, 9 miles apart, the Bethlehem and the Maudsley, and the teachers move between according to their specialisms and skills, etc. Here we have a separate school building, which is fantastic. It was designed, it's a bit old, but it's fantastic the way it works. And down the Maudsley we have rooms within the hospital itself that we use as classrooms. In terms of resources, it's an interesting one because hospital education is a strange beast. It's only recently been acknowledged as existing by the DfE. And there isn't a clear, when you talk about resources, it isn't clear what hospital schools or services or PRUs get. At the moment they're funded on historical levels, and we're working very hard with the DfE to try and make sense of the diversity of need. And one of the strange things about hospital schools and resources is that unlike primary schools or even special schools or secondary schools, our population is incredibly diverse in terms of needs and abilities.
Sure.
Because health affects the population. It does not choose to affect the parts of the population necessarily. It is very broad spread. So our population is very, very diverse in ability and need. In fact, more diverse than the normal population.
John, can you please tell us a bit about your career?
Well, I never planned to be the head teacher of a psychiatric hospital school, and I'd be very worried about any adolescent who wanted to be. So it's a series of accidents in lots of ways. I had started doing a degree in history and politics, then moved on to do drama and English as a teacher, and then taught in mainstream secondary schools for several years until I saw a job coming up in this hospital school as a teacher. Came in working outside my age range but with primary, and that was a real shock, and loved it, but it was just covering maternity leave. And then I went back to mainstream, got phoned up by the head teacher, came back in with the adolescents and loved it more. Then in the 90s I thought I'd extend my knowledge, having got interested in the psychology and psychiatry of what was going on for these young people. I thought I'd go off and then train as an educational psychologist, and did that for 10 years. And then was phoned up by the head teacher who was retiring, and they were really scraping the bottom of the barrel. Clearly nobody else had applied, and they said, would you come back as and apply as head teacher? So I did, and I got in, and I'm very glad because I can apply those educational psychology skills alongside the teaching.
Your school is a hospital school. So it's quite niche and quite special in terms of its needs and the children it caters to. So how do the children get into your school?
different parts of the school in different ways. In the two adolescent units, which are acute, then they come often as emergencies. There'll be some precipitating crisis, and it's usual for us to go into morning handovers and find out that somebody was admitted at the middle of the night. And there'll be very little information about them. With the younger pupils, in up to 12, there usually is a more planned admission. Not always, but it's usually more planned. So there'll be something which is really confused, or questions that have been raised by a team, perhaps at tier three, that they want clarification on, and so that child will be admitted in a planned way. For the eating disorders part of the school, there is a very clear run-in to that, and there is a commitment by each of those young people to engage with a seven-week program, day program, and therefore that's different again. Does that help? But there's one more developing part which kind of goes alongside new models of care for the NHS. Which is an increasing number of day patients from more of a regional area. We do take from local, regional, and national referrals, but increasingly, obviously, the day patients have to come from relatively near. And that is focused on trying to stop people becoming admitted and keeping them going in their communities. So it's a developing part of the school, and is day patient based rather than inpatient.
If we can just move on to a more general and more mainstream kind of school, because the mental health affects everyone across, and probably slightly overlooked in the mainstream schools, I would imagine. So can I ask you, what do you see as the big challenges every day in terms of mental health in schools?
I think for those young people who have very acute disorders, where the symptoms really do interfere with their functioning in schools, it's quite hard for most educational provisions to have the skills or experience to respond to those effectively. But that's at one end. At another end, schools have always had these young people in their provisions. Some in special, but a lot in mainstream. But more identified, I think. I think in lots of ways there will be a lot of the young people who were here who come from special schools, but only about 20%. Most come from mainstream settings. So in many ways, schools have had the experience in the past of trying to contain, successfully or not, a lot of mental health need, but they haven't known it. I think what's interesting is the way that over the last few years, the raising in the profile of mental health generally amongst the population has also happened in schools, has also happened in the DfE, and now schools are much more aware of that need. But there's a paradox. Whereas before they may have felt confident in addressing the more anxious, more depressed student without necessarily going straying into clinical categories. There's a feeling at the moment, which we've noticed, that in some ways they're de-skilled. With the raising of the profile of mental health, it's almost as if they are retreating from the level of competence which they've built up through experience. And there's a slight risk that they may perceive that only other people with the training can do it. And I think there's probably somewhere in between. There's a way of using the skills of CAMS teams and mental health specialists to engage with schools and build on their knowledge of how to practically address children's problems.
That brings nicely to what I was going to ask you next. We cannot avoid the green paper discussion.
No, it's fine.
The recent green paper on young people's mental health has given an impetus to the whole discussion about mental health provisions in school, basically. And one of the recommendations, which has come, of course, under huge scrutiny by practitioners in mental health, is the Mental Health Support Network with a mental health lead in every school. What is your opinion on this, and what outcomes do you think would most benefit the schools?
I think it's great that this is being looked at, that there are going to be pathfinder authorities or areas which are going to take this forward.
Mm-hmm.
The benefits, I think, are to consolidate on the skills that those professionals have and the experience that schools have in addressing the needs of those children there and then, and hopefully addressing them before they get worse. The fantastic thing about schools is they're a universal service. And the great thing about schools is for most young people, they go. One of the things about Ofsted is that they expect that attendance in schools should be 95% or above.
Right.
If it goes below that, the schools are in real trouble. So in many ways, you have a universal service where the children are there, these problems emerge, and the access for those mental health support teams and the presence of a mental health lead in a school gives probably one of the best opportunities to address individual need at an early stage effectively. That's the wish, that's the hope.
I've been closely watching the debate around the mental health support network recommended by the Green Paper. The other side of the argument picks up about two important things. One is there could be a slight danger of overstretching the teachers, and there is also a slight danger of over diagnosis of a mental health issue.
I think there's a couple of things about that. I think there's possibly been very strong focus on mental illness within that model, rather than mental health, and I think that needs to be rebalanced. I think if there's a popular statistic, isn't there, with 1 in 10 children having a clinically diagnosable disorder.
Yeah.
And there's a different way of looking at things in terms of stretching teachers. If you are, say, a mainstream secondary teacher, when I started as a secondary teacher, I worked out I was teaching over 250 children a week. So, in other words, one might consider that 25 of them would have had some kind of problem. After about 5 years of teaching in secondary education, teachers would have a significant experience, therefore, of teaching and addressing in some way the needs of a very large population of children with psychiatric disorders. But it's never been acknowledged. And one of the things that I find, and this is linked to what you're saying, but one of the things I find talking to teachers is their perhaps lack of realization of the level of experience they have
with children.
As a profession, teachers, beyond any other profession, have the widest experience of what is normal and what isn't. And so in many ways, they are a great place, great resource in terms of mental health for addressing problems. And at the moment, I think there is a risk, the way this is being perceived, that schools' experience is not being acknowledged, that what schools, good schools, do is not being captured.
Right.
And that there is a risk that you will have perhaps screening programs using something like the SDQ, where they will see those people who fall into the different categories and they will immediately refer to CAMHS. But better schools might be able to see, yes, we can see this is a problem, we're addressing it like this, and perhaps rather than relying on external specialists or passing the problem on, we'll work with the external specialists to develop and acknowledge their skills and to learn new ones. And that would be my hope.
That's an interesting view again, John, that you're saying that the teachers are already doing without realizing they're doing it. We might as well capitalize on that and make it easier for them, perhaps in some way of training and probably some extra resources. We don't know what it is, but that would be the best way forward. That's very interesting.
Can I just add something to that? Mm. One of the things that may come out from... I was at a meeting yesterday, a roundtable meeting, DfE and Department of Health. They were trying to work out which areas to focus on. Are they going to focus on the areas which are the big, have the biggest level of problems? Mm. I can see that's a big challenge. I think within this, it would be a missed opportunity if people don't look at those areas where there aren't, where there are significant social problems, but there aren't stretched mental health services, where the referrals are relatively few, schools which don't seem to pull in CAMHS support very much, and look at the reasons why. Is it because they are ignoring the problems, or is it that they have ways of helping to address them which are effective? So in other words, I do hope that within all this, they look at negative data, which is where things aren't problematic, and look at what those schools do to address that.
Yeah.
And then try and build that alongside the mental health professionals' input into models where you get better schools.
Mm.
The danger to me is this could be a sticking plaster, which may hide the systemic problems in schools and allow them to behave in ways which are not particularly healthy for the populations, rather than change them.
Do you see a bit of let's not bother until something bothers us?
What, amongst the schools?
Yeah.
No, I think at the moment they're quite de-skilled. Since 2014, mental health has become its own category of special educational need, and I thought that would change things really positively. Interestingly for us, what it's done is it's made schools feel inadequate and de-skilled, and ones that previously would have said we can manage this now say we don't have the training or skills to do this.
Right.
One of the things I've said to teachers or asked them is whether they've ever had the experience of, say, an ed psych or clin psych or speech and language therapist, CAMHS professional coming in and giving them advice about a particular child, and have they ever had the experience of thinking, but we've tried that already? And that can then get into a bit of a professional tussle, but I don't see it that way. What I see is that rather than thinking the external professional's advice is not valid, is that perhaps teachers need to acknowledge that they have those skills but didn't know.
That brings it away.
It goes back to, yeah, it's the same thing, but it's interesting to me at the moment that there's a danger that schools may feel de-skilled when they don't need to be, not in all areas, but in some areas.
I understand one of your research interests is happiness and well-being measures. Can you tell us a bit about how you've used in your school?
Well, one of the things that we do here when young people come in is we assess their level of happiness experienced in schools, not just here but outside. And we've done some longitudinal research on that. And we found that by asking young people some very simple questions. We asked them, when were you ever happiest in school? And when were you the least happy in school? And then we ask what was happening at those times, that we get an idea of what makes that young person happy in school. It's really simple. And then what we do is we take that information and we see what opportunities there may be within our school to replicate that and maybe to extend it. We also ask them about the happiest person in their school, so an idealised person, and ask them what makes that person happy. And so getting these different pieces of information, we're able to adapt programmes and think about personalised approaches to increasing that child's level of happiness. And we redo the measure, and we generally find that there are increases over the time that they stay. One of the things that we didn't expect to find, and we do lots of baseline measures on attitude and approach and behaviour in classes, etc. We didn't expect to see that change in the level of happiness is the best predictor of academic progress over time than any of the other measures. So
That's
this is, yeah, and I know it's quite exciting. But when you were talking about what resources are needed in this area, I suspect it may be to be able to listen to people populations and those very simple questions and think about them and then find very straightforward, pragmatic responses. In a big school, and I've done this in big schools, it's looking at areas where young people are particularly fed up or things which make them quite miserable. One school I remember, it was a mainstream school, and the year sevens, so 11, 12 year olds, found that the toilets were a really frightening place for them to go because they got bullied there. And the school put into place a very simple procedure of letting year sevens out 5 minutes before the rest at break times. Very simple. So what I'm trying to get at is that sometimes in addressing issues of happiness in school in particular, they're often very simple solutions which might have an overall
bigger implication.
Yeah. And secondly, if you know that a child in your class has a particular interest in a certain area. I was thinking of that film, Kes. Then you build on it. You use that. You find a way to celebrate that. And enabling the teacher to find out more about the personalities and the wishes and aspirations of those pupils in a really simple way is a good place to start. It's not magic, and it doesn't have to involve huge amounts of resources. I think sometimes it needs a bit of kindness and thought.
Yeah, we want all children to be happy.
Yeah, but we don't know how. And unless we ask or we find out a little bit more about them, then. And we seem to be doing that, and it seems to be having that effect on learning.
John, an absolute pleasure and privilege. Thank you very much for taking time to speak to us.
Well, thank you very much for coming. It's been great.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.